Hello, and welcome to Covered, a conversation about books with the people who write them. I'm your host, Harry Marks, and today's guest is Jocelyn K. Gly, the author of several books on productivity, including Make Your Mark, The Creative's Guide to Building a Business with Impact, and Maximize Your Potential, Grow Your Expertise, Take Bold Risks, and Build an Incredible Career. But today, she's here to help us get a handle on the nefarious communication tool we use every day in our jobs and personal lives, email, in her book Unsubscribe, How to Kill Email Anxiety, Avoid Distractions, and Get Real Work Done. Jocelyn, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Harry.
So what caused you or what inspired you to write a book entirely about managing email, specifically email in a corporate environment?
Well, as you mentioned, I've been sort of researching productivity and thinking about that for many, many years at this point. And when you look at how people are spending their time these days and you look at what their primary distractions are, email really still turns out to sort of be public enemy number one for most people. On average, most people spend about 30% of their work week on email. And so it was really about addressing that because I'm kind of always thinking about how we can kind of help people free up more time to do work that's a bit more meaningful, that's a bit more creative. And I think that email is really started to eat into that in an even bigger and bigger way. And so it was about kind of thinking about how we can manage that a little bit better so we can free up more time to do the work that actually really matters to us.
I was surprised to hear that statistic because when I see things like Slack, Twitter, Facebook, I would think those would be more of a distraction and would eat into what email used to eat into, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, it's funny. You would think that email usage would be on the decline as opposed to, sort of continuing to increase, especially with tools like Slack. But I think it's that, I think what's actually happening is that we're getting more and more sort of non-relevant inquiries on email just because, number one, our email sort of follows us everywhere on mobile. And so we can kind of constantly be responding to it. But additionally, just, we're kind of entering this moment or have entered this moment where sort of anyone on the internet has access to you. If I want to get in touch with you and I don't know you, I can usually find your email address and I can show up uninvited in your inbox. And so I think we're all dealing with a lot more superfluous messages in many ways, although a lot of that maybe more relevant work dialogue has moved for some people over to, channels like Slack.
Yeah, you talk in the book around page 20 about how emails lack social cues, like gestures, facial expressions, tone of voice. Is that exacerbated in our social media heavy society?
Well, what you refer to, of course, is this concept I talk about called the negativity bias.
Right. It's funny. I saw someone on Twitter actually mention negativity bias, and I was like, I wonder if they read Jocelyn's book.
Perhaps. I learned about it from Daniel Goleman, who's sort of the father of the term emotional intelligence. And so just for people who are listening who aren't familiar with that concept, the negativity bias is basically this idea that in between sort of the writing and the receiving of every email, every message gets sort of downgraded a few positivity notches. So if I feel positive about a message when I write it and send it to you, you probably feel neutral about it when you receive it. And if I feel neutral about the message when I send it, you probably feel negative about it when you receive it. And that's, as you say, because of this lack of sort of the social feedback loop. So normally when we're communicating, right now anyone listening can hear my vocal tone. If I were there in person, they could see my gestures, see my facial expressions, and all that modulates how you read the intent of the words that I'm saying. But in email, all of that is absent. But one thing that Goleman found was that people still wrote emails as if all those social cues were present. And so that's kind of why we are sort of, constantly having these sort of disproportionately, negative reactions to emails or writing emails in which we feel like we don't understand why someone took it so badly. And I think that to answer your question specifically, it totally does play out on social media. It totally does play out on Slack because, right, those are the same sorts of channels where you're communicating purely in word. But I think that the difference is on those channels, sometimes the communication is a bit more instantaneous, whereas email is asynchronous. So you know, if you're communicating with someone on Slack, you're at least more likely to maybe get a response from them quite quickly and be able to sort of, you know, modulate or adapt what you said with, you know, maybe not hours or days or weeks, you know, in between when that message was originally sent. So I think it's a little bit easier to do damage control, so to speak.
Right. Do you think the way we communicate changes, not just between services and platforms, but also the devices we use when we move from desktop to mobile or vice versa?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think certainly, I mean, you know, certainly when you think about mobile, I think that, you know, you just think about the context in which someone is usually communicating on a mobile device and the context in which they're in when they're usually, say, on a desktop, and how they're significantly more likely maybe to be focused on a desktop, whereas they're significantly more likely to be, you know, on the go or doing something else on mobile. So to me, that's kind of the biggest, that's the biggest factor, you know? And so I think so frequently when we're kind of just dashing off a message on mobile, you know, it has sort of a high chance of going wrong. But I think it's more about state of mind than the device itself.
Before I get into my next question, I actually did want to talk, because the negativity bias email, you say there's a kind of debt that's felt when an email is sent that we need to respond. Mm-hmm. How is it that we can sort of fight that feeling that we, you know, every email that comes in deserves a response or requires a response?
Right. And so that's this idea of sort of the rule of reciprocity, which is this, you know, concept that we're humans, we're social animals, and we like to, you know, return a sort of positive action with another positive action. And the sort of important qualification for that is, you know, even if we didn't want someone, say, to do us a favor, we still feel compelled to return that favor,
right,
regardless. And, you know, even though, of course, many email messages don't feel like a favor, of course, you know, we still do, I think, feel some of this sense of reciprocity if someone, you know, took the time to write us, you know, a thoughtful message, to learn something about us, or, you know, to make a certain request. And I think it's quite, you know, I think that leads to a lot of email guilt for most of us. But I think that number one, we have to be sort of cognizant of that implicit bias, just even understand that that's something at work, you know, behind our urge to respond. And then we have to just sort of cast that in the larger context of, you know, how much email can I really realistically respond to while still, you know, pursuing the things in my career or in my work a day that are really important to me. And I think we have to start to, you know, let go of this idea of inbox zero and think more about, you know, what is this, what is a realistic ratio of these messages that I could actually respond to? You know, if you're getting 300 messages a day, it's not really realistic to respond to 300 messages a day. And I sort of use the metaphor of, if you think about, you know, if you translated every single email message into a physical piece of mail and you thought about, you know, oh, I'm getting 200 pieces of mail a day, you would never think you could realistically respond to all of them. But somehow when we get email, when it shows up in this digital form, we feel like we should completely respond to all of these messages, and it's incumbent upon us to do so. So I think thinking about it in almost that sort of physical mindset, you know, if you got physical mail, you would say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to have to start templating some of these replies. I'm only going to respond to this small percentage that is really, you know, important and really relevant to what I'm trying to accomplish. And you would probably say, you know, well, some of them maybe just aren't even going to get a reply. And I think that we have to start kind of applying that same type of discrimination to our inboxes and really just, you know, let go of that idea of inbox zero, which I think for many people is becoming very unrealistic.
I'd like to talk about inbox zero, because I had many years ago seen Merlin Mann come to speak at Rutgers. And Merlin Mann is I believe he is the originator of the concept of inbox zero. And it was something I know a lot of my friends are big strivers of inbox zero, the need to get your inbox down to nothing. But you say that's an unrealistic goal. Why is that?
Yeah, well, and I think it's a personal decision. For some people, it may be totally realistic, but I think for many people, it's not. And I think what's really important to understand around the term inbox zero is the context in which that term arose. So you're correct, Merlin Mann coined it, and I believe it was in March of 2007. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened in June of 2007 was the introduction of the iPhone, to the very first smartphone, which obviously, you know, led to sort of seismic changes in the way that we get information, how frequently we receive information, and in particular, how we receive email. So it's just really interesting, I think, to recognize that that whole concept came before we had email on mobile, before our email could follow us around, you know, before we lived in this era of the internet where almost anyone could kind of track you down and send you an email message. And even when he sort of first put forward the concept, Merlin Mann sort of put forward the concept within the framework of thinking about like how you could minimize your time on email. You know, it was never about just sort of like blindly getting to inbox zero. It was always about sort of using your time more wisely. That's what his sort of whole perspective and approach was about. And so I think at this point, you know, it's just important to note that that idea literally is from almost 10 years ago when we lived in a completely sort of different communication and technological environment. And so we have to really, you know, revise our thinking about that. And is that concept even useful anymore?
There were some things from his, when I saw him speak and from his website, 43 Folders, that I really appreciated. And it's something that now that I see it all the time, it really irks me is I see people with email inboxes with 6,000, 8,000 emails in them. Nothing is ever deleted. Nothing is ever archived. It's just a long stream. And because they use their email inboxes as a to-do list almost. They keep their emails there as a reminder. Oh, I need to get this done. I need to get this done. But is that like a toxic mentality to have so much email in your face all the time?
I mean, I think I can't remember what it was. I actually read something about this recently. Like, I feel like there's some, you know, I think there's some certain threshold, right, at which it starts to become unrealistic. And, you know, in my mind, I feel like it must be something over 1,000 messages, at which point you kind of go, you know, mm-hmm. who cares anymore? Like, it starts to become a message that you can't really, really contemplate anymore.
It's sort of like when it gets, you know, 10 degrees out and then it drops another 10 degrees and you're like, well, I can't feel it at this point anyway. So just right. let you're it get like, colder.
It's cold.
Right, like, exactly.
It doesn't really matter how cold, you know, it's you're like, okay, I have too much email. I can't catch up. Like, right. You still can't catch up no matter how much it is. I'm not a huge, you know, you mentioned using your email as a to-do list or certain things of that nature. You know, one thing I suggest a lot of very tactical and very practical tips in the book, but my sort of whole aim with Unsubscribe and with anything that I write related to productivity is that there's not really one sort of, you know, silver bullet or one sort of system that works. I think it's much more useful for people to understand more how productivity works. You know, what are the psychological concepts that I need to understand? Why is email so addictive? What are the things that are particularly damaging about the way that we use email? You know, things like kind of constantly checking it, constantly multitasking with email. Mm-hmm. And make sure that people kind of really understand what is so toxic about it so that they can then decide based on, you know, their kind of own workflow and their own needs, what's the best, you know, type of approach to take. Because I think that everyone's sort of approach to productivity and to email needs to be very personal and sort of, you know, based on the needs that they have and tailored to them. And then I think you feel a lot more ownership over it when you kind of do it yourself.
Yeah, I actually tried doing one of your techniques, which is check your email at set intervals throughout the day. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I did it for one day because I shut off my email, I started doing another task, and then I would get a phone call from someone, you know, down the hall, oh, did you get my email? And it just turned into a thing where I kept having to restart my email because mm-hmm. I kept getting calls, did you get my email? Did you get my email? So what do people in that situation do if they can't follow a lot of the techniques in the book because mm-hmm. their workplace just doesn't allow for it?
Right. Well, I think, so just to sort of back up for a second and explain kind of, you know, I really advocate in the book checking your email in batches. So just to kind of explain why that is first, you know, there's kind of two approaches that people have to email. They're kind of either checking it usually reactively or they're checking it in batches. And most of us, you know, kind of fall into this reactive category, right? So we're kind of constantly nibbling on our email throughout the day. It's very notification driven. We're constantly multitasking with email. The alternative approach would be to be batching, you know, so you set aside sort of clear, you know, specific times of day, maybe 2, 3, 4 times a day, which you say, you know, I'm going to check my email for whatever, 30, 45 minutes. You focus 110% just on processing your email. And then, you know, you kind of set it aside so you can spend, you know, 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours at a stretch focused on other work. The reason that I suggest that is that research has shown that, you know, taking that approach, batching, makes you more productive, it makes you less stressed, and it makes you happier. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, as you say, that's not realistic for everyone. So I think what's important to understand is what you're trying to avoid with batching, right, is sort of two things. You're kind of trying to avoid, creating an expectation with other people that you're sort of constantly available on email, which I think, you know, kind of leads to the proliferation of email and sort of treating email more like a conversation than an asynchronous, communication tool, which, you know, then sort of leads to more email. And secondly, you know, you're trying to basically avoid multitasking with email, which is extremely damaging to your productivity in general. There's a study that was done in the UK of people who were, you know, constantly juggling email with other tasks, and it had the effect of lowering people's IQ about 10 points. Every time you switch from email back to another task, switch from maybe, you know, being really focused on tasks, checking your email, switch back to that task, you also pay a switching cost, which typically takes you about 25 minutes to get back into that maybe zone of focus that you were in before you just decided, you know, take a quick peek at your inbox.
Right.
So, you know, those are huge sort of penalties to pay in terms of, you know, your sort of productivity and your stress level and even just, you know, your sort of intelligence that you're able to call upon, your cognitive functioning that you're able to call upon at work. So that's what we're trying to avoid with batching. But it doesn't have to be, oh, I only check my email 2 times a day or 3 times a day. You know, I think if it's more about going, you know, for a certain stretch, really focused on things that are not your email and not constantly interrupting yourself. So I think if, you know, going 2, 3 hours at a stretch without checking your email is unrealistic, one thing you can try is a more sort of Pomodoro technique approach to batch checking your email. You know, so the Pomodoro technique is sort of working in 25-minute sprints. Mm-hmm. You know, so maybe say, okay, I'm going to work in 25-minute sprint. Let me take 10 minutes to check my email. You know, then I'll go back and do 25-minute sprint, that type of a rhythm. Alternatively, I think that we can also set up other things. One of the things I talk about in the book is, say if you use Apple Mail, is using something like VIP notifications. So, you know, typically it's not that you need to get every email. You know, you need to monitor every email. It's just that you maybe have emails from a couple of key people, which I like to sort of think of your VIPs, that you really need to make sure that those people feel taken care of and that you get those emails immediately. So thinking about, you know, can you set up VIP notifications or the 3, 4, 5 people you can set as VIPs, and basically that will bubble up a text notification so you can feel comfortable ignoring all of the other email that really is not that important and that you don't need to be interrupting your work for, you know, and kind of bubbling up those more important emails. So that's just kind of two ideas. You know, I think you have, so I think, you know, as you say, everyone has different needs, but the point is to think about how you can really turn down the noise. You know, I think probably about, 10 or 20% of the emails that you get, if even that many, are worthy of interrupting whatever you're doing to check that email. So how can you kind of isolate, you know, those emails, make sure you're getting those emails so you're not just letting like anyone who happens to show up in your inbox really lower the quality of your, you know, work throughout the entire day.
Yeah, I know some people who, when they get a new iPhone or if they, the first thing they do is they shut off all notifications on email, all badges, sounds, banners, all of that. And then I use an email client called Spark from the company Readdle. I believe it's for Mac and iOS. And it's a similar concept to the VIP. It only shows me notifications for emails from basically from real people. Any newsletters, any marketing mailings, I never get notified of unless I go into the app. But if I get a rejection letter from an agent or an email from you or someone I know, that will bubble up to the surface and I'll see that first and foremost.
Yeah, and I think that's super important. I think a lot of people just feel so overwhelmed by email, they take no time to sort of just customize it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And as you say, there's tons of applications. You use Spark. I use I use one called Easily Do Mail that I really enjoy. And there's a bunch of other applications out there. I actually have a piece on my homepage of my website right now, jkglei.com. That's like 17 different applications that you can kind of use to tweak and modify your email in different ways. And so there's a huge proliferation of tools and even sort of, you know, more AI-driven apps that are coming up for email, which will hopefully, you know, I don't think they'll ever sort of be able to remove the headache of email entirely, but I think they will be able to get a lot smarter about, as you say, kind of bubbling up the more relevant emails. So I think those are really important things for people to kind of look into and, you know, figure out how to kind of tailor it best to their workflow.
Today's episode is brought to you by Nocht Sound Engineering. Nocht helps you record, edit, and produce great podcasts, streamlining the process so you can deliver high-quality shows to your audience. Whether you just need to trim the ums and you knows, or you're looking to set up the perfect recording rig, Nocht has it all covered. Speaking of, Nocht makes every episode of this podcast sound terrific. Consider this more than just an advertisement, consider it an endorsement. So if you're looking to bring your podcast to the next level, contact Nocht Sound Engineering today at nochtsound.com. That's nachtsound.com. Nocht, more than a stack of tracks. Yeah, in the book you talk about optimization and tweaking the system to work for you, but at some point, does all that constant constant optimization just breed procrastination?
Oh, I think that's a very good question. I think it's completely true. And, you know, you look at something like, for instance, you know, trying to create maybe a email folder system that will, you know, sort of account for every possible message. I think that's one of those instances where, you know, your sort of impulse to organize can pretty quickly jump the shark. I was just reading a piece by Tim Harford, the economist who just came out with the book Messy, which is really fantastic. And he was talking about a study which showed that in large part, you know, any type of complex email filing system was, you know, it's basically been proven to be sort of largely useless. Because you can't really plan for every instance in the future, right? And so if you just sort of end up endlessly tweaking your system. If you're going to do a folder system or something like that, something very simple, very broad strokes, you know, three folders, four folders is kind of all you want to do, you know, just to sort of help you sort it a little bit. And so I do really think that you don't want to be, obsessively optimizing. That's not really my, you know, I think some productivity people would definitely sort of advocate for that. I think it's more like, you know, just every 3 months, you know, maybe set aside an hour or two to just think about your email system, like go take a look. Are there some new apps, you know, out there that I could be using that could help me, you know, take a few minutes to think about, okay, what are the emails that are the biggest drags on my productivity? Like, do I need to create a new template, you know, sort of Gmail canned response to respond to this one type of inquiry that I seem to be getting all the time now, and I'm wasting, you know, 5, 10, 20 minutes every day responding to these types of emails. So just kind of making time, you know, on a regular basis every 3 to 6 months to just kind of look at your system again, I think it's plenty. But I think most of us are so overwhelmed that we devote zero time to thinking about our email. And that's where the problem really comes in. And to me, that's why it was kind of worth it to actually write a whole book about email. And, you know, it's a very short book, like, you know, pretty sort of breezy read. Yeah. You know, you can read it in maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours.
And then the back half is like sample text for certain emails and checklists and stuff.
Yeah. Trying to be like super, super practical. I don't think anyone wants to read a big heavy tome about email. The goal is really just to say,
I'm sure there are some people who would.
Some people, not even me though. But I think, you know, the goal is more to say, you know what, email is actually a huge distraction and a huge drag for most of us on our productivity. And, you know, let's just take a moment to think about it holistically and to come up with some solutions. And if you spend that time, you know, if you spend whatever you say, you know, okay, an hour and a half, 2 hours reading the book, and then 2 hours optimizing your email, the amount of time that that 4 hours can save you over the long run is massive. There was, I don't know if you saw it, there was a Washington Post article recently that took some data from a study that Adobe had done of how creatives used email, and they created this really terrifying email calculator that could that projected basically how much time you could potentially waste on email over the course of your entire career.
Oh, wow.
And the number that they came up with, I think it was over like a 50 or 60 year working career, was like, was 5 years. Like, you could spend 5 years of your life on email.
I believe it. I've been at my current job for 6 years and I've already felt like I've spent 5 years doing email.
Right. But think about it. Like, it's like, oh, but what if I spent 4 hours, you know, every 6 months just thinking a little bit about this one thing? Maybe I could, you know, you could cut that down by, you know, 40% or something.
Right.
So I think it's one of those things where small actions make a really big impact.
I think there's been a huge, ever since email has gained in proliferation, especially in corporate America, I think there's just been such a huge overdependence on it that mm-hmm. it's replaced phone calls, it's replaced face-to-face meetings. And in some mm-hmm. instances, it works. Not everything requires a meeting. But sometimes picking up the phone is speedier than having a long conversation thread with someone.
100%. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I talk about in the book. I think that email is definitely one of the mediums where I think we sort of tend to be extremely lazy, you know? And so if someone contacts us on email, you know, we sort of stay within the channel in which they initially opened the conversation. But I think especially when we're, you know, trying to be a bit more efficient, trying to use our time more wisely, you know, you have to recognize that email is, you know, extremely not good for certain types of things, whether it be having a delicate conversation, brainstorming, you know, discussing an issue with very complex details, you know, all of those instances, you probably want to see someone in person, or, you know, pick up the phone so you can have a 2 minute conversation instead of, you know, maybe a tense email exchange that involves 20 messages or something of that nature.
Right. Yeah. I'd like to jump back a little bit to our conversation on, you know, the tweaking and the optimization, because I had interviewed David Sachs, the author of The Revenge of Analog, a couple of weeks ago, and I had asked him a question about the fetishization of analog tools, like all the Kickstarters mm-hmm. about fountain pens and notebooks and stuff. mm-hmm. And I'd like to ask you, do you think with all the books and the blogs and YouTube videos on bullet journaling and like Charles Duhigg's Smarter, Faster, Better and Unsubscribe even, you know, is there a fetishization of productivity going on? Especially with like David Allen's Getting Things Done and that kind of thing?
Oh, yes, certainly. Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a huge, huge, you know, explosion, and of course the self-help and the productivity, you know, system in sort of obsession, I should say, in general. And I think a lot of it actually relates to the fact that because of all of the shifts that are happening in technology, you know, creating, you know, maybe, you know, there'll be a bunch of jobs that I don't even know what they are right now in the next 5 to 10 years, right? We're seeing, you know, whole sectors of the economy, like manufacturing and, you know, driving taxis and stuff, just dying off and getting erased. You know, there's about 8 million jobs of people who drive trucks that are about to be vanish, you know, by self-driving trucks. And you think about, you know, you may occupy a job or do something in the future that you didn't even know, you know, would possibly exist right now, maybe 5, 10 years, you know, who knows, 5 years ago, did you think you would be doing a podcast? Did you even know what a podcast was? You know, that type of thing. And so I think we're living this environment where the future is so uncertain, you know, that we have this sort of understanding, number one, that we kind of constantly have to be bettering ourselves and that we constantly have to be developing new skills. Mm-hmm. But additionally, it makes us sort of yearn for like any level of control that we can have over our work and over our daily lives. And I think that this sort of obsession with self-help and this obsession with productivity and, you know, with things like, you know, bullet journals that sort of make everything kind of look and feel extremely organized and you're on top of things and you know where you're going, you know, that type of thing. I think that's all kind of a reaction to that long-term uncertainty, you know, so you really want to feel like, well, at least I have control right now.
Right.
You know?
That's actually why I obsessively clean certain parts of my house when I'm feeling overwhelmed is because that's the only thing I can control at the moment.
I would say I'm guilty of the same habit myself.
You know, we've had email for 25 years more. And why do you think it's still a problem? Why do you think books like Unsubscribe still need to be written?
Well, I think that, you know, as I said, I think that the sort of shift, you know, just the rise, I think the rise of mobile, you know, and the idea that our email and our work could follow us anyway, kind of undermined any, you know, sort of gains or understandings that we had had of, you know, how to use things like email. And that kind of shifted the game again. You know, it was like, okay, I got it now. But like, wait, now that my email can follow me anywhere, like, what does that mean?
Right.
And I think that those changes are going to continue to happen, you know, right? It's, you know, it hasn't really blown up yet, but, you know, you think about things like Google Glass, or you think about, you know, the rise of virtual reality, like, you know, where are emails or any type of technology going to be following us in the future? Like, we don't know. We're going to constantly be having to make those, be making those shifts. But one of the other things that I think is happening is with email in particular is that, and the reason that I think that it hasn't really sort of you know, died in the way that maybe some of us thought or wished that it would, is that, you know, number one, it's kind of like the universal language of global communication. So at this point, it's kind of like everyone ages 5 to 65 understands what an email is, understands how to email in a way that, you know, they do not understand necessarily how to use Slack or other things of that nature. And additionally, I think it's like it's the sort of last, one of the last unowned technologies. You know, you think about Slack, you think about Facebook, you think about any other number of game-changing companies, but they're privately owned companies. So they have, you know, objectives. They're different than something like email that isn't really owned by anyone. And that kind of allows email, I think, in a way to kind of, you know, constantly adapt and change in a way that makes it, you know, sort of constantly survive and grow in a way that, you know, is a bit more challenging maybe for, you know, private entity or a private company.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. It's just, it's interesting to after all this time, after all these years, you know, working in corporate America, that people just still have no idea how to handle, not just reading their email, but responding to email, I think is the bigger one. For example, I have a question. It's a simple question, I think, but you'll tell me, what is your opinion on the basic thank you email? Not thank you for, you know, interviewing me and giving me an opportunity, but like I send you something and then you send back to me, thanks.
Oh, whether or not you should send those emails?
Yeah, okay. I hate getting them, and I always feel weird sending them because I feel like I'm clogging up someone's email inbox.
So I have a very clear perspective on this, or clear opinion on this one, which is I think that if you are genuinely, thoughtfully saying thank you is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. So one thing that I mentioned in the book is that there's some research done by, I believe it was Adam Grant, the author of Give and Take, and another researcher friend, Francesca Gino, on sort of appreciation and saying thank you and what's its relative importance. And they actually did a study where they had people use email, and they basically enlisted some people to, you know, give people feedback on, I think it was like cover letters or resumes. You know, so I would like email you my cover letter resume, and you, person who is enlisted into the study, would then like give me feedback on my cover letter resume. And then the people were either instructed, once you sent me that feedback, to just send an email that said like a sort of receipt, you know, like I received your feedback. Mm-hmm. Or to send an email which, you know, you expressed like some, you know, real appreciation for the feedback that had been given. Mm-hmm. And what they found was when people expressed, and this is all happening specifically on email, when they expressed sort of a sincere appreciation, that person was twice as likely to help them in the future. And wasn't just twice as likely to help them, but was twice as likely actually to help anyone in the future. So I do think that sending thank you emails, if they're, you know, meaningful is really important. It actually is, you know, makes someone more likely to help you again in the future. And it makes them more likely to help anyone in the future. But, you know, I think that, and I think that a lot of us have that feeling of like, oh, you know, I'm not going to, you know, I won't send that thank you email. Like, I'm not going to clutter their inbox up with that, you know? But actually there is a strong benefit to, you know, to sending them. But I think you do actually need to, it doesn't have to be long, but maybe like a sentence, like you do actually want to say something, you know, right, as opposed to just like, thanks, exclamation point.
Yeah, I can't say I won't get annoyed getting those emails, but at least I'll feel a little better sending them. so there is that. Do you think email is going anywhere anytime soon, or?
You know, I mean, for the sort of the reasons that I went into a little bit earlier, I don't think it's going anywhere. I think in a way it's kind of this kind of cockroach of the internet. I think that it's incredibly resilient. I think that it is incredibly, I think while it's becoming maybe less used for, you know, things like immediate, you know, inter-office communication, which is being replaced by things of Slack and that nature, you know, it's just still an excellent asynchronous medium for, you know, dealing with anyone whom you work with remotely. And particularly for, I think, and I think we're starting to see this shift, it's becoming more and more a way of approaching people whom we don't know well or who we are not, you know, closely acquainted with. You know, whether it's me, you know, I used to manage a team of maybe 30 writers who lived all over the globe via email, you know. So these are people in different time zones. Something like Slack is not in any way like a useful way to manage those people. And it's, you know, a universal medium that everyone knows how to use, you know, or for things like approaching someone you don't know, say to speak at a conference or something like that. Like, for instance, I used to do a big conference at Lincoln Center in New York every year, the 99U conference. Mm-hmm. And I invited Stuart Butterfield, the founder of Slack, to the conference. And you know what? Like, I didn't use Slack to invite him because I can't connect to him on Slack. And I don't, you know, I didn't know him at the time, so it would be inappropriate. You know, it's like me like knocking on your front door when I've never met you, right? So email is, because it's an asynchronous medium, it's slightly more distant. And so it's more appropriate for those types of approaches. So, you know, I think it's going to be, I think it's going to shift and it's going to morph, but I, you know, I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah. And I do marketing and there really is no better way to spread the word of some thought leadership piece or some sort of advertising, you know, unless you're to getting it directly into their inboxes still seems to be the best return on investment.
Yeah, precisely. I think it's as you say, great for sort of one to many communication as well. And you see, you know, you see the rise of newsletters, you see the rise of companies like MailChimp happening.
Yeah, you get a lot of information in one place. You don't have to shoot them a very small banner ad or a small tweet or something. You can get you can spit a lot of stuff at them.
But I think that you are seeing that shift to maybe email, you know, becoming more and more maybe, you know, you're having less and less kind of personal communication and more kind of impersonal, you know, people you don't know reaching out to you or, you know, getting sort of marketing or personal newsletters. That type of thing is growing and growing. And so I think that's, you know, that's part of it too, right? That's part of the email challenge is that we have to really shift our focus because we are in the situation now where there's just a lot more noise than there used to be. I actually just, what were the numbers? I just read a piece in the Harvard Business Review that studied managers and how they dealt with their email. And the numbers were something like, you know, managers were spending like 30 or 40% of their time on email responding to, you know, sort of irrelevant or non-urgent messages, which is, you know, pretty alarming, obviously.
Yeah, if you're running a company, you know, you shouldn't be wasting your time with.
But I think that's kind of a testament to sort of taking this, like, you know, this inbox zero idea that we're all kind of clutching onto and carrying it over to this, you know, what's this sort of shift in what's happened in our inboxes where there is a lot less, you know, there's a lot more stuff that's irrelevant. And so we have to shift our mindset and make sure that we're not wasting a lot of time on that irrelevant stuff.
Right. I have 8 emails in my work inbox and it's driving me crazy looking at them. I just want to get rid of them and say that part of a project is done or something like that. But to your point about the noise situation, the same way I get excited about getting a real piece of mail, snail mail in the mailbox, like a letter from someone or an invitation, it's gotten to that point with email. When I get an email from a human being and not a marketing server, I get excited and it's like, I want to open this and respond to this right away because this is such a rarity now.
Yeah, well, and that's that, you know, I think idea of this sort of random rewards that I touch on in the book that makes email so addictive, that, you know, that sort of concept that your email really is, you know, kind of like a slot machine, right? Most of the time you sort of pull the lever to check your inbox and you get something that's kind of, you know, disappointing or even upsetting. You know, if your boss is asking you to do something you don't want to do, or, you know, there's an email from an angry customer. Mm-hmm. And so most of the time you kind of lose, but every once in a while you sort of, you know, pull that lever and check your inbox and you get something great. You know, it's, you know, an email from a long lost childhood friend, or, you know, an invitation to speak at a conference that you're really flattered by, you know, and those random rewards are that thing that makes email seem so exciting and so addictive, because you kind of never, you know, you sort of never know what you want to get. And that's that thing that makes us really, you know, just driven to constantly be checking it again and again and again.
You're a podcaster and blogger. You need an analytics and hosting platform that provides you with the right tools to make your job easier, so you can get back to doing what you do best, creating stuff. FeedPress is a delightfully intuitive RSS analytics and podcast hosting platform with accurate analytics for RSS feeds and email newsletters. Bloggers and podcasters tap into RSS subscriber, geolocation, podcast download, and link tracking metrics, which come standard on all plans. In a matter of minutes, podcasters can create a feed and publish to iTunes, add your show notes, artwork, and drag and drop an MP3 into the editor to go live. Every podcast plan comes with 400 megabytes of file storage that's unmetered. This means you won't have to worry about running out of storage for long episodes or getting dinged for a sudden spike in download traffic when your podcast becomes an overnight success. FeedPress offers an automatic feed burner migration tool, so you can make that transition with ease. Your feeds and subscriber data will be moved into your FeedPress account. And if you're currently hosting a podcast elsewhere, they can help you migrate your feeds and media files over so that your listeners don't notice you've changed anything. Support is responsive and available 7 days a week via feed.press/contact. Sign up today and try FeedPress on a 14-day commitment-free trial at feed.press/covered. Use promo code COVERED during checkout to get 10% off your first year.
So I'm going to put you on the spot here. How close do you adhere to the techniques in your book, or do you find yourself slipping sometimes?
Well, you know, one of the things I adhere fairly closely, but like everyone, you know, things will come up, or, you know, my work situation or project load will change, and, you know, that will change the way that I deal with email. So, you know, kind of case in point for me, the difference between, you know, the period of time in which I was writing this book and then the period of time in which I was launching the book. So, you know, those were like very different modalities for me. So when I was writing the book, you know, it was really important to me that I didn't check my email, you know, until at least 11 in the morning, you know, that I spent those sort of first 3 hours of the day writing and not checking my email, because I didn't want to let any sort of, you know, anxieties or distractions or anything into my mind before I was trying to really, you know, move forward on writing and sort of a bigger writing project. But then when I shifted to launching the book, it became really important, you know, to be very responsive. You know, if there was like press that came in and, you know, say someone, you know, in the UK wanted to interview me, and I live in LA, and so they're 8 or 9 hours, you know, ahead. So I really needed to be like very responsive about getting back on the emails to make sure it was kind of, you know, helping things move forward, because I want them to move forward. So, you know, so like the message about the book gets out there. So I think that, one of the things just thinking about that shift made me cognizant of is, I think, you know, and I talk about in the book, the sort of importance of having a daily routine, you know, and kind of having these rhythms of when you're checking email, when you're not checking email. Excuse me, you can hear my dog in the background there.
Sorry, we're very dog friendly on this podcast.
That's good. he's very talkative. So, but having those daily rhythms, having those daily routines, right? There's really been, you talked about sort of fetishization. There's really been a sort of fetishization of this idea of the daily routine. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great. And I think that daily routines are really powerful for helping us do great work and for also kind of helping us ward off distractions, whether they be email or anything else. But I also think that it's interesting to think about the idea of having sort of different templates for your day, because every day isn't the same, you know, or every sort of season of the year or season of your work isn't the same. And so we have changing demands, you know, where when I'm promoting a book, I need a very different template for my day than when I'm writing a book. You know, and maybe, you know, you have, you know, certain days where you're, you know, you have some type of like marketing emergency, you know, and so you need like a template for that day. And then you have days that are a little bit more chill, you know? So I think about not just like this idea of this one rigorous daily routine, but more, you know, thinking about different templates or just understanding that things change, you know, are always going to be changing and adapting, and new problems are always going to be emerging. So we do have to, you know, I don't think we need to be, you know, we're talking about constant optimization. I don't think we need to be, you know, trying to optimize every single day, but, you know, preserving some time or just some downtime in your schedule, you know, every couple of weeks or once a month, just to kind of say, well, okay, like, is this still working? Is what I'm doing still working, you know, or do I need to adapt and tweak, and what do I need to look at? And kind of just being aware that the way that we all work is changing so rapidly and the demands of our projects are changing so rapidly that we do kind of have to be cognizant of constantly, you know, sort of zooming out and just getting a little perspective, maybe making some small tweaks.
To that point about balancing everything and being adaptable, there's a part in the book around page 66 where you talk about setting expectations with companies that expect, you know, if they basically, how do you set expectations with certain companies if they expect you to be available after hours? Like, I work for a global company and I'm getting emails in the middle of the night from Asia that if I don't check my email first thing in the morning, I'm walking into a minefield first thing. And you managed a team of 30 people who were all over the globe. So how do you do that if you're working for yourself? But more importantly, how do you do that if you are not in a position to say to your boss, I'm sorry, I'm not answering email after 5:30 because I'll be out of a job in a second?
Completely. Yeah. Well, I think one of the most important things that I talk about in that section of setting expectations is just actually like just having some open dialogue with, you know, your team, with your boss about what is acceptable, and what are the expectations. Because I think that, you know, most of us sort of set a default expectation for ourselves, with work and with email, that it's like, okay, always on demand all the time. You know, so if my boss emails me at 2 p.m. on a Sunday and, you know, I'm like relaxing in the park, like too bad, like I've got to respond to that email, you know, because that's what they expect. But the situation may be that, you know, your boss just really likes to catch up on his or her email for 4 hours on a Sunday, you know, and they're just like, I'm catching up. And they're not thinking about the impact on you of like how that's just going to like ruin your Sunday every Sunday because you feel like you have to respond to their message immediately. Maybe they don't expect it. Maybe they do expect it. But I think it's really important to just have that discussion with it, with your internal team, with your boss. You know, just to even, you know, I think sometimes, you know, the answer might be, yeah, I expect an immediate response at all times, you know, and that's kind of disappointing. But I think also sometimes people will surprise you, you know, and maybe they're just doing things thinking about themselves and not thinking about the, you know, the sort of urgency or anxiety that that creates for you. So I think it's good to have that dialogue. And also, you know, particularly with coworkers, also trying to sort of set have a dialogue about what communication is the right medium for what type of thing, you know? So like if you're working with people in an office, you know, like, okay, you know, if you have an urgent question, like just come to my desk or, you know, Slack chat me, like don't put that in an email. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have something that can wait until tomorrow or a few hours, like then it's cool to email me, you know, just kind of getting on the same page about like what even makes sense for the types of mediums to use. You know, that's not all, it's certainly not going to solve all of your problems, but I think that we almost never, ever, ever have those discussions. And it's really useful to just open up that dialogue and realize like, okay, you know what? I was doing that thing that was really stressing you out. And like, I don't actually need, you know, you to respond to my email at 10 p.m. at night. And now you know that. But, you know, everyone has their own demands. As you say, you know, if you're working with people in Asia, you just got to check that email first thing in the morning, you know, and if that's something that creates some anxiety for you, you don't like to do it. And, you know, maybe you would rather be sitting with a cup of coffee and doing some really deep writing for 45 minutes. Then it's like, okay, well, you know what? I have to do that. Let me think about something that could be sort of a reboot ritual for me before I get into my writing, after I respond to those emails, to kind of clear my mind, clear that anxiety, you know,
go idea.
For like go for a walk, like meditate for 10 minutes, you know? So I think you just, you know, everyone's demands are different, but I think there's always sort of creative ways to, you know, talk to people, set some expectations, or also just create some little rituals for yourself where you can kind of make, you know, maybe not the most desirable situation a little bit more tolerable.
I like that. I like that idea a lot. So what is the main thing you want people to take away when they read your book?
The biggest thing that I want them to take away is under, you know, for me, the most interesting thing about writing the book was researching, you know, the first section is sort of purely based, goes into the psychology of email and the psychology of email addiction. And as you and I kind of touched on earlier in the show, that same sort of psychology, you know, thinking about negativity bias, thinking about the rule of reciprocity, thinking about random rewards, all of these things also apply to many of the other technologies that we use on a daily basis. And to me, I think when we want to change our habits, the first step is really just to become really aware of why we're doing something. I think it's quite difficult to understand, you know, to effectively change a habit if you don't understand why you're doing something in the first place. So I think, you know, I really want people to kind of become aware of some of that psychology behind why email is so addictive, but also behind why just all of these technologies that we're using in general are so addictive, so that you can then kind of and use that psychology to create, you know, systems or approaches that allow you to really put them in their place. I reference that old, there's kind of an old expression that tools make excellent servants, but very poor masters.
Yes.
And I think we're really in a situation right now where we're, you know, so unused to the power of technology in many ways that we really let these tools become our master. You know, we really let email tell us what to do with our day, what to do with our time, what to do with our focus. You know, and the same thing with, you know, Slack or other social media channels. And I think we really have to step back and think about, well, how can we, you know, make these tools our servants? How can we, you know, retake control and sort of become the master of these tools? Because I think if we don't do that, you know, I think it's like you look up 2 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and you're like, what have I been doing with my time? You know, and you realize that you've maybe been letting this sort of random group of, you know, mix of sort of coworkers and strangers who are showing up in your inbox kind of, you know, dictate what you did with your life and what you did with your career. And, you know, I think that most of us have probably fairly specific ambitions that we would really like to achieve, but we're really letting technology kind of pull us off course from some of those things.
Yeah, we've spent 5 years doing our email.
Yes, I want people to avoid spending 5 years on email. We want to distill that down.
Excellent. Well, Jocelyn, thank you so much for coming on today. This has been great.
Yeah, it was really fun chatting with you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Where can people find you online?
They can find me at my website, which is jkglei.com, and they can find information about Unsubscribe and just a lot of, you know, writing and articles related to sort of productivity and careers and really how to find more meaning and creativity in your daily work.
Excellent. This has been Covered with special guest Jocelyn K. Glei. Links to Jocelyn's books and all other titles discussed will be available in our show notes and on our website at hologramradio.org/covered. Thank you for listening. If you like today's show, I would love it if you took a few minutes to subscribe and leave a review in iTunes so other book lovers can better find us. And if your podcast listening app of choice gives you the ability to recommend us, please do that as well. I'd like to thank our Patreon patrons, Kyle Wallace, Alex Knight, and Aaron Mankey, for their support. If you are able to give a dollar or two an episode to help fund more great interviews like this one today, please consider supporting Covered at patreon.com/covered. And if you fancy other Hologram Radio shows, such as Dave Kalo's brand new Serial Sommelier, and would like to drop a few dollars their way, you can support the network as a whole at patreon.com/hologramradio. All proceeds go towards covering bandwidth, hosting costs, and equipment upgrades. You can follow me on Twitter at HCMarks and the show at Covered_FM. Thank you to TJ Cosgrove for a beautiful logo and Lorenzo Gudemi for all the hard work he puts into making this show sound fantastic. And as always, thank you again to Feed Press and Knocked Sound Engineering for their support of this show. And next month, because I'm not entirely sure if I'll get an episode out between now and then, but on February 9th, I will be at the AWP 2017 conference doing a panel on literary podcasting. So more details on that, and hopefully I can get a show out of that one as well. And remember, don't judge a book till it's covered.